Welcome to Soul Practice, a podcast featuring raw conversations about our crazy world and real practices that keep us grounded deep in our souls. Soul Practice, Raw Conversations, Real Practices is hosted by Kathy Escobar and Phyllis Mathis.
Welcome back, everybody, to Soul Practice, Raw Conversations, and Real Practices. I'm Kathy Escobar.
And I'm Phyllis Mathis.
And we're having fun with guests. And so this has been a really big part, is just to bring our friends into the conversation and be together and share and learn and just get that juice that we get when we're with other people who are on this crazy journey and trying to really live in a deep and meaningful way in a harsh and hard world. So our friend Aram Haratunian is with us today, and Phyllis is going to share a little bit about him. I knew Aram, I think, before you, though. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, that's not.
It's
not true.
Yeah, 1997.
Yeah.
Damn it.
Yeah. 1997, maybe it was 98 by the time.
How did that happen?
It was a crazy story. I'll tell it later. Get them going. It's a crazy story, though, that I do love, because you know what? It really fits in everything about Aram, how I met him, because he's a gem.
Yeah. Well, I think it was, I was trying to think about it, but I think it might have been 2003 or 4 or 5 that I met you, Aram. And so Aram Haratunian is, I was going to say former pastor, but only officially former, because we think of pastors as people who hold the office. And I would say that Aram is one of the few people that holds the vocation or the calling, regardless of what environment he's practicing in. Even if he was working as a salesperson selling furniture or something, he'd still be pastoring because he has that essence about him, you know, really connects with people, really creates spaces for them, and actually does the work of companioning in a spiritual way, which I value. And I think everybody who comes in contact with it, with that sense of values. And so he used to be a pastor, then he was a hospice chaplain, and now he's working also as a chaplain in a adult living center in Denver. And the reason I wanted to talk to Aram more is we had a conversation with Aram and his wife Ellen at our home a few months ago, and we were just chatting about this and that, and you said, Aram, the older I get, the more I realize that presence is everything. And that really struck me. It's not like a new thought, but I was so curious about all the ways that you experienced that and how you got there. Like what, you know, all those, the streams of your life and work that went into that statement, because a lot of people say that, but I know I could feel in that moment that was something that you've been pondering. So I also think that that's true. And I just wanted to unpack that. And from your experience, I don't know what goes into that sort of realization for you.
Thanks, Phyllis and Kathy. Great to be here with you both. You know, so many levels of this in my work, but I think that, Phyllis, we've talked about this. The thing that I think really spurred it for me was my years in hospice prior to this, visiting our patients in nursing homes. And, you know, we've all heard the stereotypical image of a bad nursing home, you know, and I've seen them all. And I know all of them in the Denver metro area. And I would go in and, you know, sterile room, nothing on the walls, you know, just a curtain between two beds, you know, not a whole lot of privacy. And I just placed myself in that position thinking, how would I survive that when I see some people who are just like, God, just take me, kill me, please take me. And then there are other people I came across that just seemed to be, they were just, I would leave like, wow, just wow. And I'm like, wow, how did they navigate that? How do they do that? And they had this sense of just presence about them. They had this sense of taking everything in and enjoying every moment. And I'm like, wow, I want to be like that.
Yeah.
And I'm so far from that. And so that is what I think about, stew about constantly as I watch my own health decline and as I see the health of my residents decline, and some handle it well and some don't handle it well. And I'm just fascinated by that. So that's kind of what really stirs it for me. But, you know, at another level for me, it's like, you know, we're talking about presence and I said presence is everything. But for me, it's like, I say that because I'm so not present. And like, here's for me, the every day, my office is sort of in the back of the building and the printer is on the front of the building. And I have to walk about a 50-yard walk to get from my computer to my printer. And I print out stuff all day long. And to get to the printer, I have to walk past the elevators where all the residents congregate and through the lobby where all the residents congregate. And I can walk. And am I going to be present to these people? Or do I have a task? I have a lot of tasks I have to get done. And do I make eye contact? How deep is my eye contact? How much of my heart do I offer in that moment, knowing that it could be a 20-minute conversation at any given moment? And so for me, it's like constantly all day long. And even in our orientation, we talk about offering presence, offering compassion, offering your, say, a warm hello, you know. And so every moment of the day, I get to make decisions. I get to choose. And so I just realized so many of the times I'm communicating, I'm sending off vibes. I'm not present. I've got a task to do, you know?
Wow.
So.
Oh my gosh. I totally relate. I mean, this is, it's different, you know, the some of the spaces that I move in where, but it's the same. Where it's like, I really do. I love connecting with people and
yes.
I love being yes. with them, but then I have shit I got to get done and I can't get out of the parking lot. You know, I'm just trying to get out of my car. I just want to go in and get something done. And then, you know, as I hear you talking, I'm reminded, like, whoever my friends are in those moments, like for all different reasons, at the refuge, a lot of people have been sleeping in their cars all night. They're hungry. They just want to eat. They want to share something fun. They want to share something hard. And,
yes.
And, yeah. You know, I'm not saying I'm supposed to be available at every minute of every day. You know, that's not sustainable. But I do notice that if I can just like take a breath and just kind of at least try to be more present in that moment.
Yeah,
it is those little connections that really matter. Mm-hmm. And they're really annoying sometimes. And they're annoying. And then they also, you know, they get in the way of other things that if we measure them, and especially when we're confronted with the realities of life and death, the things that I actually want to go do don't really matter that much.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they don't. But it's hard because I want to get them done. So I think people listening probably feel this tension too. It's like, it's hard to be present. I mean, it's really hard to just be with humans together, connected, mm-hmm. without agendas and without trying to get to the last thing or to be stuck with the past thing. So,
yeah. And being in this environment where death is always in front of you, and death and decline is the great stripping away. And it's like, what is really important? And so that's where I hope I'm going, and I'm trying to mature in that, you know, all these things, yeah, they're important and I do got to get stuff done. But boy, what's at the end of the day, what really matters? And I'm watching these folks, and as their health is stripped away, their abilities to move are stripped away, and my being able to walk that 40 yards is going to be stripped away. What's left? You know, and I'm so cognizant of that. And so where am I going? Where do I want to be?
Well, one thing I wanted to ask you if you could share is, of the residents that you have there, the ones who are present, like, what are they like? What do they do? How can you tell? And how do they kind of call you to be present too?
Oh my. Yeah. Yeah. You know, there's one woman, her name is Sister Nancy. She's a sister. Yeah. And she's my go-to person. And when I'm freaking out and when I'm exhausted, you know, she walks the hallways very slow. She has her walker, her health is declining. But she always will stop and just give herself to me. But she gave me some words. She gave me some words, you know, and she sees me and she watches me. And I'll never forget these words she gave me one day. She said, "Aram, there are two things." She said, "Number one, make it your daily intention to ask this question when you get up. How will I be today?" Mm. Not what will I do today, but how will I be today? And then she said, "It's not what I do, but how I do it." Wow. And those words have haunted me. And so I watch her in how she does what she does. And she's available for our staff in ways that I, the chaplain, are not. I mean, she is just so available for them. And so, I don't know, an availability. Another thing, specific, you know, we're a Catholic organization, and not everybody, but 2/3 of the people there are Catholic. And within the 2/3 of the Catholics, this is not everybody's cup of tea, but a lot of them get involved in the rosary. And we have it not every day, but almost every day at 3:00 in the afternoon. And if you're familiar with the rosary, it's just 30 minutes of repetition. You know, it's "Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus." You know, and they say it over and over for 30 minutes. And I look at that and part of me is like, just shoot me. I mean, I'm like, that is insane. That is crazy. But, you know, the more I've thought about it and the more I watch them, I'm like, oh my goodness. They're the contemplatives. They can sit still for 30 minutes and just, for me, I'd be like, give me my phone. I'd be just wandering all over the place. Get me through this. But they're like, they sit there and they're present to those prayers and they just enter into them for 30 minutes. And those folks are, you know, and I watch them and how they live their life, and they have this centeredness about them, this calmness about them. So when you ask that question, I'm like, whoa, could I do that? I'm not, that's advanced 101, you know, I'm in 101, that's advanced stuff for me. And one of these days, I've never done this. I'm going to sit there just to sit for once, 30 minutes. I'm afraid to do it. It's just, how do you,
I love that. And when I think about other religious or spiritual practices that have that kind of, chanting or, I don't know, I haven't done them, but I've heard about, like, if you go to an ashram or a Hindu practice where there is this repetition as part of their contemplative practice. And now, as you were talking, I was wondering why is that? What is that? You know, and as I have struggled with sleep over the last many years, I wonder if this is part of it, that the mind needs a little landing space, like it needs a little something to kind of occupy it. Yes. So that the rest of your brain can go to sleep.
Yes.
And so I'm wondering if the kind of repetition and that quiet, it's like it sets the magician mind aside.
Yes.
And kind of calls up this other presence or this other stillness or these other faculties that we have maybe besides the mind. And that's kind of been my thing for the last few years, just thinking about my mind sometimes is my worst enemy and really the obstacle to so many things. And meditation is hard, you know, it's hard to let go of the thoughts and all of that stuff. And it makes me think maybe I should take up something like that just sets the mind over there and then wakes up the other faculties we have.
Yes. We have, you know, our common friend, Tom, you know, years ago once said to me, he looked me in the eye and he said, Aram, you have an overdeveloped magician.
Yes.
There's sovereign, there's, you know, and poet, and I'm the magician. And I've got monkey brain just par excellence. And so, yeah, I think that could be a great practice.
We need to do a whole episode. I just thought of this on the four gateways. So let's table that and do that because it'll be really good because sometimes people haven't heard about it and just kind of thinking about it in this moment and that in all of them, in different ways, presence is this big thing because you have to be attuned to now and there and recognizing what's going on. And I really love what Nancy said, how will I be today? How am I going to be today?
And it's not what I do, but how
I know. I mean, where do I ever ask that question? I'm like, okay, what do I got to do today? And I have a list this long, and it doesn't mean that it doesn't include connecting with people, but I never really ask that question of myself. Like, how am I going to be today? And I do know the difference when I feel anchored and not grounded and present. I mean, I know the difference, but I love that as a framing question.
It's haunted me in a good way. You know what? As I thought about coming on this morning, you know, one other thing I really want to talk about is this thing, Phyllis. And this is what I see in these folks is it's the surrendering of the ego.
Yeah.
And you know, I've talked a lot about Kathleen Singh and the grace in dying. And I remember Phyllis and Ted and Ellen and I were in Mexico years ago. And I was reading this book, you know, The Grace in Dying. And every morning at breakfast, I'm like, you gotta hear this. And I'm reading them, you know. I've mentioned this. It's like my Bible. It was my Bible for hospice, The Grace in Dying. And but she talks about how death, the process of death, it's really stripping you, your attachments to things, accomplishments, appearances. It's just mercilessly stripped away.
Yeah.
And, you know, whether it be driving a car, oh my gosh, when you watch when a resident has to give up driving a car, you know, going to the bathroom, loss of control, stripped away of their kidneys, of their, you know, just incontinence. And she says, she talks about how there's this threefold process of chaos, surrender, and transcendence. And it's just blown my mind where the whole dying process is when it's all these attachments and things are irrevocably stripped away. And there's a turning point, which she calls surrender. And it's, she said, it's not entered into lightly. And there's this battle going on. And she says, there's this, I'm going to read this. There's this stark moment of recognition at the very end of chaos, where surrender differs from acceptance, that the force that is bringing about the death of me is far greater than who I think I am. And there's a fear and a terror in realizing that. And there's this fear of engulfment and a power that is infinitely vaster than who we imagine ourselves to be. And then she says, surrender seems to occur in a split second, and it's the greatest U-turn we can make in the spiritual journey. And she says, it's the opportunity of a lifetime. And then she says, in this moment of surrender, and it happens in a nanosecond, we move to the recognition that this power, which a nanosecond ago appeared to be wholly other, it is exactly what I've longed for my entire life. It's our heart's longing. In the process of dying in that moment, surrender instantly goes into emerging with grace. So then she says, it's not how to die gracefully, but rather to make it familiar. And I'm like, oh, yes. That's it. It's how do I make this dying process familiar? Through the rosary, through my walk from my office to the printer. It's like making this death process familiar. And then she talks about, you know, this whole thing of die before you die. You know, it's in, I read a book on all the books of the dead, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the Egyptian Book of the Dead, the Celtic Book of the Dead. Every one of them has this idea, die before you die. So when you die, you will not die. And so it's just, it's dying. It's this death. It's this stripping away. And I'll just end with this. Singh says, in dying and death, it chooses us, but we during life have the choice to choose it. You know, it's like you have no choice at the end. It's going to happen. It's going to be stripped away. But what the mystics have learned is do it now. You have the choice to do it now and make it familiar. And so that's what I see when I see these folks. And it's like, wow, can I get there? You know, how do I get there?
So. Oh my gosh.
Mind blown. Sorry. We just have to take a little explosion pause.
I can't say enough about Kathleen Singh and what she's taught me. I mean, and this, I share it with my residents and you can see their jaws drop, you know, cause they know it, you know, and it's just amazing. So.
Well, the thing that couple things, one that I'm thinking when it is, you were saying die now kind of thing. I think how ironic it is that surrender or that shift over that pivot, whatever that is, not just about dying, but it's like getting to life, to actual living.
Yes.
And I kind of want to just take the whole death thing out of it in a sense, because death is really the only thing that forces us. It's the only thing powerful enough to force us to come to our freaking senses. You know, it's like, oh my God, my control over the universe and everything is breaking. And oh no, it feels like death. You know, it's like when the ego dies, it's like a big drama queen. You know, it's like, oh, I'm dying. Oh no.
That's an awesome quote.
It's over. It's like, yeah, whatever. You know, it's just on the other side of the collapse of all of our control and our cultural, you know, that's where life starts. In I think, theoretically, here I am talking theoretically, but it just feels like it's so sad that the way we live our lives and the way we've been taught to live our lives and the lives that we've inherited from our brutal kind of cultural history is that some of us never do learn how to live, number one. And then the ones who do, it's only at the end when they can't, when they can't do the things that they've, you know, we've been clutching on to do. And so, yeah, I've just been thinking about the, you know, the miraculous existence of life itself, and to shed, if we could shed the things and just experience life, aliveness, kind of helps me think about that, versus I don't want to think about death. I'm sorry. I don't want to think about death. I want to think about being alive, but it's kind of the same thing. Yes. If that makes any sense at all. Yeah.
It makes me think of the, that it became familiar, that would become familiar to us in just integrating. I mean, in so many ways, it's just a wholeness, and we just don't like the whole picture. Mm-hmm. And the whole picture is all of it. So it is life, it's death, it's not knowing when we're gonna die. Any of us can go any minute. And it's not about the stuff, the tasks, the doing, the, you know, all the, I love that the ego, when the ego is dying, it's going to act like a drama queen. That's the best.
and in hospice, you know, in extreme cases of that, you know, it's called spiritual agitation, where literally the person is crawling out of their skin. And it's almost like you're watching the surrendering of the ego, where they're giving up the last vestiges of control. And it's painful to watch, you know? And so, you know, what we learned in hospice, and Kathleen Singh says this, is like, well, what do you do as a family? You can only sit there, you know, maybe play some antiphonal music or something, but there's really not a whole lot you can do, but just sit with them. As it's like watching a birth and going through the, you know, I'm not, you know, a transition. And you can just stay, you can just be there and watch and hold their hand, but they've got to go through it. And it's, I mean, literally. And you know, what's fascinating is you watching them do this. It's like, it's almost like when that shift happens, there's this incredible peace. I mean, I've seen it over and over again. They go through this and they hit transition, and then there's this letting go, this surrender, this peace. And then shortly that thereafter, they die, and they die in peace. And it's beautiful. It's just lovely. And it's just, to me, it's a, and I share this with family when they're watching their loved one go through, you know, we call it terminal agitation, and they just start crying. You know, it's like, what I say to them is they're working out their shit. They're just, it's just everything. It's like that verse in the Bible, everything that was hidden will be shouted from the rooftops. Mm. That used to bring terror to me. It doesn't anymore. It's beautiful. It's like, get it all out. Just get it all out. And there's grace. And that's what Kathleen says. You're just bathed in grace, you know, and it's beautiful.
Yeah. Can we do that now, please? You know, without dying, without the death at the end.
I know.
Well, I wonder if that's a little bit of like what we're trying to get at in the big picture. And, you know, I always worry about people listening, going, you know, well, that's what I want, but I can't get there. You know, it's like that thing. It basically is what we talk about here all the time, like coming, approaching healing even as a task.
Yeah.
Approaching it all as like something I got to sort out. I got to be peaceful before I die. And so I don't have regrets. And so I live like all these things that are probably more performative, ego-y.
Yeah.
And simpler. But then on the other hand, really, this is like just coming back to your basic premise that's so powerful is that actually it's in the not trying so hard to sort out all the shit, but to honor it and to be open to it and to reveal that it heals without having to work so hard to do it. So it's this weird paradoxical existential thing that
it really is paradoxical. It really is. You know, it's like, it, during life, it's like you think you're choosing it, but really death chooses you. You know, it's like you've got to, It's like, we think we're in control. We're not, you know?
Yeah.
And there's this grace at the end that, and that's what that really comforts families, is when they see their loved ones going through transition, as we call it in hospice. It's like, it really is a grace. I know it's painful to watch, but it really is a grace. It's okay. And then when they see, when they come on the other side and there's this peace, it's like, oh, wow. You know? And yeah, we don't have any control over it. It chooses you.
Yeah. Well, certainly at the end, you know, when I work with people who are in, who have going through really rough times or circumstances beyond their control, or the collapse of maybe a marriage or a family or something kind of life altering, you can witness that same thing, maybe to a lesser degree, but it's like when things are breaking down, this is what I learned many years ago, conceptually and then personally, the blessing, if you want to call it, of a breakdown is that the things that we are clinging to that give our life structure and make sense to us and give us a sense of being able to predict and control things. There are lots of times in our lives where those things shatter, they break. And we kind of need it to be beyond our control. Like very seldom can we choose our way into this thing. But when breakdowns happen, it is a mini moment of grace like that, where you can't control everything. Like you can whine about it. You can be mad about it. You can, you know, complain that you lost something, a job, a career, a family member, a marriage, a partnership, money. Or you can let it collapse and be a breakdown. And the breakdown is sort of like, you know, for me, it was a faith breakdown and some other things, a career breakdown. It was a lot of things altogether. And the image that I had was like of a war zone, like a city in rubble and all of the things scattered, you know, and then just thinking that, okay, there might be something on the other side of this, and I could just bulldoze all that shit over there and then just kind of rest in the nothingness of it. And so I think that we do get opportunities to experience this before, you know, before the 2 weeks before we're going to die, you know.
Right.
And there can be surrendering. And I used to think of surrendering to God, you know, I'm surrendering to God, you know, I did that every single day. But that wasn't as effective as just surrendering my control and surrendering my predictions and surrendering my kind of ego freaking outness. And I have experienced little parts of grace in that way, as I've been able to do that, but we're so addicted to picking up all the things again and being in charge again and being on top again, you know, that those moments tend to be few and far between.
Yes.
It makes me wonder if, you know, Buddhists and some of those people talk about enlightenment, you know, if this is what they're kind of talking about, this sense of, oh, I think I get it for a while here.
It makes me think to just for younger people, we're in the older side of things, and it makes me think for younger people, this is a really hard world to live in, and I'm not saying it's our world was hard and our world is hard, but the young people, my dog is doing so many annoying things over here right now. And so it's like, she's like a toddler. She's literally a toddler. And so she's like, mom's busy. So anyway, I think for younger folks trying to survive, and, you know, this is really special to my heart because of our situation with Jarrett. I think this world was really hard for Jarrett. Mm. And I think it's really hard for all of us. But I think a huge piece for younger people is definitely some of these skills of learning how to not get caught up in all of it and come into our bodies, come into our souls, practice the smallest thing. And it is tricky because not very many things are taught this way. And even though mindfulness and those things are getting more play, it's still in a world that is just nutty and from every direction. And so, you know, just this ongoing practice of humanity, like we're humans, we can't master this. You know, Aram, I mean, you're in the thick of it and you struggle with it. You've got it up close personal and it's super hard to do. And so like just remembering, I feel like there's this grace in it that this is probably, no matter the age, it's a lifelong practice, but we can get better at it. And some just really takes talking about it and then noticing, how am I going to be today?
Right, right. You know, it's funny, you mentioned your dog. I've got right in front of me, it's this sheep. I brought this with me today, but it's a boy sitting next to his dog, and the boy has all these thought bubbles, you know, of his car and money and, you know, things he's got to do today. There's just millions of thought bubbles coming out of the boy. The dog has one thought bubble. It's the image of him sitting with his master, his boy, you know, and I love that, you know, it's like, it's like, there it is, you know, the dog just is like me and my boy, you know, and we're sitting next to the dog thinking of a million things. And what's the one thing? Just for a second, you know. Last night we had a not a funeral, but a vigil. One of our residents was a priest, elderly priest, and he died. And we had the vigil there. And there was this, and usually whenever we have funerals or things like this at the gardens, I am just monkey brain is times 100 because I'm thinking of all the things. And something happened last night where I was able to just take in the music, just take it in. And I don't think I was trying. It was like, it was gift. And it was a gift. And I was like, huh, this is interesting. Normally I can't do this. I'm so worried about making sure everything goes right. And there was this gorgeous song and I was fully able to enter into it, which for me is rare with my monkey brain. And so just receiving it as gift and those graces come and just paying attention to them and maybe cultivating them when they come, and maybe I can become more aware of them and just in little bits.
Mm, so good. I mean, what Phyllis said is so true. Aram's like the world's best pastor.
Yeah.
He's literally the world's best pastor. And when I met him in 1997, maybe early 1998, I think it was 97 though, later in that year, I met Aram because he showed up, just him, me and somebody that was walking through with me healing from a past abortion in high school that I've spoken a lot about over the years. This special healing season that I had that I really needed to just unpack that and embrace that into my story and be able to speak about it freely. And he came. She asked a pastor, because she knew him, to just come and hold this space with me to wrap up this. I never knew him. He walked in. It makes me cry when I think about it, because he just walked in and showed up and was present and held that shitty pain. And I will always remember it. I remember the moment. I remember where I was. I remember what it felt like. It is really true. Aaron, presence is everything. And we need humans to help us hold these really hard things in our life and in our death. And it means being available. Like, you probably had 10 other things you wanted to do that day. Nobody paid you. Nobody, like, you just heard of a hard thing and you showed up. And so thank you. It's a total gift.
Yeah. I remember that moment, Kathy.
It's so wild. And it's a huge piece of my story.
When I kind of met you officially later, years later, I had totally forgotten about that. And you reminded me, I didn't even know it was you because I didn't know who you were, you know? And it was like, and then you told me, and I'm like, oh my gosh, that was you.
It's so weird. Random lady moved to Colorado. And but those things really matter. And you are a gift. And I do want to keep talking about death more, not for the sake of just dying well, but because talking about death and embracing it can help us live well.
Mm. Die before you die. So when you die, you will not die. You know, and again, that's in all the ancient wisdom literature. It's there in all the books of the dead. Die before you die.
Oh my gosh. So good. Well, we always wrap up with the last little thing for the soul and maybe a practice. So if you just give us the last little from your perspective and then Phyllis, and then we'll wrap up.
I just have to leave it with what Sister Nancy shared. It's not what I do, but how I do it. And so I just want to make that intention. How will I be today? In and go out from here with those two thoughts.
Yeah. That's fantastic. I hesitate to add anything else, but I do think, so here's the thing about the soul. Your soul is already living there. Our souls are already living there. And we can drop into them and listen, because our souls are completely countercultural. Our souls are completely alive and well. And we just can't believe that, and we don't know how to go there. And so I just want to remind us all that your soul is already living in that peaceful place, and we can find our way there.
That's so hopeful.
Oh, so good. It's so good. And so, yeah, on the practice side, I mean, I'm just going to go with what Aram said, what Sister Nancy said.
What he said. Yeah. What he said, she said.
So tell her thank you for.
I will.
Yeah. Tell her thank you.
It's taped on my monitor of my computer at work. It's like I have to be reminded of it all the time.
It's so good. So she gave a gift to us, the three of us, this morning, and then she's going to give a gift to everybody listening. So thanks for listening, Aram. We look forward to next conversation, and we love you, and thank you for helping us keep finding our way in this harsh, hard world.
Thank you.
Escobar and Phyllis Mathis write, speak, pastor, and counsel, and are dedicated to creating spaces that foster healing and change. You can learn more at kathyescobar.com and phyllismathis.com. Keep listening to your soul and keep practicing.